So imagine deciding to manually drill exactly 1,000 microscopic holes into a bare fiberglass circuit board.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and you aren't doing this in some, like, high-tech lab. You're doing it on a workbench in the late 1970s.
Right.
You're meticulously placing 41 separate silicon chips, you know, soldering countless resistors and capacitors. And then, because you don't actually have a computer case, you just rip the guts out of an old tape recorder.
That is amazing.
Right. Use the empty plastic shell to house your creation. And the real kicker here, the author of the document we're looking at today did all of this as a nerdy alternative to watching the World Cup.
Yeah. It immediately paints a picture of a very specific type of mind.
It really does. Welcome to today's deep dive, everyone. We are looking at a deeply personal, highly technical PDF simply titled Cygnetics CPU 2650.
And right at the beginning, the author drops this incredible quote from the legendary Dutch soccer player Johan Cruyff. He says, "You'll only see it when you understand it."
I love that quote.
It's perfect, right? It anchors everything we're about to discuss. Because this isn't just a nostalgic look back at retro hardware. It's really a thesis on how digging into the raw physical logic of early computing is kind of the only way to truly demystify the hyper-advanced devices we use today.
Exactly. Our mission today is to go back to what the author calls the Stone Age of personal computing. Because the contrast between then and now is... I mean, it's just staggering.
Oh, holy.
In the 1970s, computing was dominated by these massive punch card mainframes taking up entire rooms. And there was even this popular catchphrase going around in the Netherlands, "Fujivan de computer."
Right, which translates to computer error.
Yeah, computer error.
Yeah.
It was the ultimate mysterious scapegoat for any administrative screw-up. And that was largely because the general public had absolutely no access to these machines. They were just like mythical beasts.
And the isolation from that technology is hard to overstate. I mean, the author mentions getting their first taste of programming around 1975, and it wasn't on a personal device.
No, not at all.
It involved staying late after hours at work, sneaking in time to learn HP Basic over a period of months. Computing time was this scarce, highly regulated resource.
Which makes what happened next so interesting. Fast forward a bit to 1980, and we see the arrival of the home Pong console.
Ah, yes, Pong.
Just a little plastic box hooked up to an analog television. You have a square block bouncing horizontally and vertically, and you control it by turning knobs.
Revolutionary for the living room.
It was. But the author notes something crucial here. The novelty wore off incredibly fast. Once you mastered the timing, the rigid, unchangeable nature of the game just became painfully boring.
And that boredom really was the catalyst for this entire journey.
Because you couldn't modify Pong.
Exactly. The logic was hardwired into the circuitry. If you wanted the square to move differently, or, you know, if you wanted a completely different game, you had to build a programmable system from the ground up.
Which leads the author to a hobbyist magazine called Electour.
Right, which had just published schematics for a DIY programmable TV game computer.
And this is where we get back to those 1,000 manually drilled holes. Taking on a project like this from a magazine schematic is, well, it's a completely different universe from modern DIY.
It really is.
You order a bare printed circuit board. You drill the holes yourself. You source the 41 chips yourself. You solder everything by hand. You wedge it into that tape recorder shell. And after days of meticulous eye straining work, you plug it in, flip the switch.
And it fails.
It completely fails.
It doesn't work. Now, think about the troubleshooting process in a pre-internet era.
Oh, man.
You can't just jump onto a forum like Reddit to check if someone else had the same issue. You can't ask an AI to check your work.
Right. You are completely on your own.
Dealing with a piece of hardware that only a tiny fraction of the population even conceptualizes. So the author spent days agonizing over the board, testing components, checking solder joints, basically assuming they made some catastrophic error.
Only to find out later, buried in a subsequent issue of that same magazine, a tiny erratum section.
The leak van a lecture.
Yeah, the leak or flaw of a lecture. The magazine admitted there was a fatal design error in the printed circuit board schematic they had published.
A literal misprint that broke the whole machine.
Okay, let's unpack this physical frustration for a second because I really want to put this into perspective for you listening. Mm. This is like buying flat pack IKEA furniture, right?
Okay.
But you have to go out and chop down the tree yourself. You saw the wood, you drill your own dowel holes, and after days of sweat, you realize the manufacturer printed the instruction manual upside down.
Ah, that's a great way to put it.
And you can't even call customer service.
No, you definitely cannot. And to fix a printed circuit board flaw of that era, you have to literally track the physical copper traces on the board.
Right.
You have to find where the electricity is being routed to the wrong logic gate, take a blade, literally cut the copper trace to break the circuit.
Wait, cut it with a knife?
Yeah. You cut the copper with a sharp blade, and then you solder a tiny jumper wire over the gap to route the signal to where it's actually supposed to go.
That is intense.
And you cannot do that blindly. You cannot bypass a hardware flaw of that magnitude without truly understanding the architecture of the system. You have to map the brain of the machine.
So the flaw basically forced the author to transition from simply, you know, blindly following instructions to deeply comprehending the Signetics CPU 2650.
Exactly. They had to understand what was actually happening to the electrical signals inside that tape recorder case.
So let's crack open that tape recorder ourselves and look at the architecture. How do those 41 chips and a bypassed copper trace actually result in a programmable game on a TV screen?
Well, the text highlights two primary workhorses: the microprocessor, or CPU, and the PVI.
The programmable video interface.
Right. The division of labor here is absolutely essential to understand. The CPU is the central logic engine, but it is entirely blind to the outside world.
It has no idea it's playing a game.
None at all. It doesn't know what a television is. It doesn't know what a pixel is. The PVI handles all of that. The PVI is a specialized chip designed solely to take raw data and translate it into an analog video signal that the electron gun in a standard 1970s TV set can actually display.
Okay, so then we have the memory architecture, which kind of dictates how the CPU operates. Now, we know the standard divide between ROM and RAM, but the physical constraints here really dictate the programming logic.
Right, absolutely. The ROM, or read-only memory, holds the hardwired boot sequence. That's the absolute minimum instructions required for the machine to wake up and recognize it even has a processor.
Right.
But the RAM, random access memory, is where the author's custom programs lived, and space was aggressively limited.
Aggressively limited is an understatement. Because memory was so small, you couldn't use high-level programming languages.
Right. There was no compiler to translate human-readable code into machine code.
So the author had to write directly in machine language using hexadecimals,
yeah.
Which means instead of typing a simple command like print, you are looking up a specific two-digit alphanumeric code that corresponds to a physical instruction set inside the CPU.
And you are manually punching that hex code into a specific memory address?
It's so tedious. And the text mentions the necessity of using something called relative addressing to make these games even work within those tight memory limits.
That's a huge point. If you give the CPU an absolute memory address, like, say, go exactly to address number 4096, that takes up a lot of bits.
It eats up precious memory.
Exactly. So with relative addressing, you give an instruction like, jump forward 5 steps from your current position. Or, you know, jump back 12 steps.
It's incredibly efficient for saving space.
It is, but the danger is if you miscalculate your jump by even one single byte, the CPU reads a piece of data as an instruction, and the entire system crashes instantly.
Boom, game over.
Exactly. It requires a level of architectural intimacy that is almost entirely lost in modern programming. And the author captures this intimacy beautifully with a specific analogy for the CPU's primary function.
Oh, the courier analogy.
Yes. They describe the microprocessor as a courier. The entire system operates on what we call the fetch-execute cycle.
Okay, break that down for us.
So the CPU, acting as the courier, goes to a specific address in memory and picks up a package. That package is the instruction.
Got it.
That package contains directions. Go to this other address, grab the data there, and deliver it to the PVI.
I love this courier analogy. But here is where it's really interesting, friend. If we think about the reality of this machine, we need to picture this courier as a bicycle messenger in a tiny town who's completely blindfolded.
Blindfolded, exactly.
Right. The messenger has absolutely no concept of the big picture.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know they're rendering a tennis game or a maze or keeping score. All they know is the literal immediate instruction. Take the contents of box A and place them in box B. They're executing mindless microscopic tasks, but they are doing them at a speed that creates the illusion of a cohesive reality on the screen.
And that speed is dictated by the system's clock frequency. Inside the machine, there is literally a quartz crystal oscillator physically vibrating.
Like a watch.
Exactly like a watch. This creates an electrical pulse, basically a metronome that keeps the entire system in sync. For the Signetics CPU 2650, that clock frequency was 1 megahertz.
Meaning 1 million cycles per second?
Right.
But the courier can't pick up, read, and deliver a package on a single tick of the metronome, can they?
No, they can't. The author notes that it took an average of 3 clock cycles to complete one full instruction.
Yep.
Tick 1, fetch the address. Tick 2, fetch the data. Tick 3, execute the command. So with a 1 megahertz clock, our blindfolded courier is completing roughly 350,000 full instructions per second.
Which is just, it's kind of hard to wrap your head around.
It is.
That is the core mechanism. Complex results emerging from 350,000 brutally simple repetitive tasks every single second.
Yep.
The CPU grabs a hex code from RAM, sends it to the PVI, and the PVI changes the voltage going to the TV screen to make a white block shift 1 millimeter to the left.
It's all physical.
But as fast as 350,000 instructions a second sounds, especially when you're manually inputting those hex codes, we have to scale this up to the device sitting on your desk or in your pocket right now.
And this is where the author draws a really sharp, humbling comparison.
Yeah.
That 1 megahertz tape recorder computer is placed right next to a completely average modern laptop running at 2 to 3 gigahertz.
We are talking about an operational speed 2,000 to 3,000 times faster.
Yes.
And that's just raw clock cycles.
Yeah.
That's not even accounting for multiple cores or parallel processing or infinitely more efficient instruction sets.
The specific metaphor used in the text is that the 1970s computer is a horse and carriage, while the smartphone carried by a teenager today is a Formula One Ferrari.
That's quite a leap.
And the author freely admits the Ferrari comparison actually falls short of capturing the true exponential gap in processing volume.
Which brings us to a major philosophical argument in the text regarding education and basically how we should approach learning technology today.
Right. The author argues that you don't put a 4-year-old in a university.
Makes sense.
Because of that, if you truly want to comprehend modern computing, you cannot start by looking under the hood of a modern smartphone.
The Ferrari is just too complex.
Exactly. It's too heavily abstracted. To grasp modern systems, you have to start with the machine language of the horse and carriage. You have to understand the blindfolded courier.
It's a plea for foundational learning.
It really is. Strip away the graphical user interfaces, the compilers, the operating systems, all the glossy layers, and just look at the raw movement of logic gates.
Okay, I understand the romance of that, but I have to push back a little here.
Sure.
Because we invented compilers and high-level languages like Python precisely so we wouldn't have to calculate relative addressing jumps manually. We built operating systems so we don't have to physically route copper traces with a knife. So what does this all mean for the listener today?
Well,
why should someone today who just wants to write an app or automate a spreadsheet go backward? Do we really need to understand the mechanics of the horse and carriage to be a great driver of the Ferrari? Does a teenager really need to learn 1970s machine language to send a text?
Well, it depends on how you define a great driver. Do you need to understand the fetch-execute cycle just to use a smartphone? Obviously not. You tap the glass, the compiled code runs, and the service is delivered.
Right.
But the author's point, and this goes way back to that Johann Kreif quote at the start, is about the difference between passive consumption and active agency.
Active agency.
Yeah. When you only interact with the highest layers of abstraction, the machine remains a black box. You are reliant entirely on the parameters set by the people who built the interface.
You become someone who just assumes Fuchsavanda computer is a real thing.
Exactly. You just blame the algorithm. When a system crashes or behaves unexpectedly, a passive consumer sees it as an inscrutable failure of magic.
Wow, yeah.
But someone who understands the courier, someone who knows that underneath the glass, it's really just a processor moving data between memory addresses, recognizes it as a logical flaw in the instruction set.
That makes a lot of sense.
Understanding the foundation removes the intimidation factor. It fosters critical thinking and allows you to interrogate the tools you use rather than just accepting their outputs as absolute truth. It is fundamentally about intellectual ownership.
When you put it like that, it's kind of the difference between being a passenger on a commercial flight and knowing the actual physics of how pressure over the wing generates lift.
Precisely.
It fundamentally changes your relationship with the experience, even if you aren't flying the plane yourself. But practically speaking, how do we apply the author's philosophy? Because if the goal is to understand the courier, but we obviously don't want to go scavenging for 1970s tape recorders and fiberglass boards, how do we get that hands-on experience today?
The good news is the author provides a highly practical modern solution.
Okay.
Emulators. You don't need the physical hardware to experience the raw logic anymore. The text explicitly points to a software emulator called WinArcadia.
So you run WinArcadia on your modern multi-gigahertz Ferrari, and it essentially creates a perfect sandbox simulation of that old horse and carriage architecture.
That's exactly it. It replicates the exact memory limits, the exact clock cycles, and the exact machine language of the Signetics CPU 2650.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. You can punch in hexadecimal codes, you can utilize relative addressing, and watch the virtual PVI output the result on your modern screen.
So you get all the profound hands-on aha moments of seeing how the raw mechanics work.
Yes.
But without the risk of inhaling soldering fumes or, you know, burning your house down.
Or misrouting a physical copper circuit, exactly. And the author actually spent days compiling all their hard-won knowledge from the 1970s into this PDF guide, specifically so anyone can download an emulator and walk this path.
It's like a highly accurate flight simulator for fundamental computing logic.
It really is. And it highlights a crucial contrast the author makes near the end of the text. Back in the 1970s, you didn't actually have to build the Electour project from scratch to play games.
Wait, really?
Yeah, the author mentions a commercial company called Audiosonic that sold the exact same hardware system, but pre-packaged as a consumer console.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, you bought the Audiosonic system, plugged it in, and just slotted in preloaded game cassettes.
So no drilling 1,000 holes.
No drilling, no soldering, no hexadecimals at all. But also, no programming. The cassettes were completely locked down.
Wow, that perfectly encapsulates the core theme here, doesn't it?
It does.
The Audiosonic route was the path of the passive consumer. You just consumed the media someone else programmed until you got bored. But the Electour magazine route, drilling the holes, bypassing the flawed circuit board, learning the instruction sets, that was the path of the active creator.
You suffered the friction of the machine language, but at the end of the day, you commanded the architecture.
You spoke directly to the courier.
Yes. Synthesizing all of this, the author's document really serves as a powerful grounding mechanism.
Definitely.
Whether you are an advanced software engineer wrapped up in a high-level frameworks, or just someone trying to navigate a world increasingly dominated by opaque algorithms, zooming out to see that one megahertz courier changes your perspective.
It grounds you.
It's a reminder that no matter how complex the Ferrari gets, no matter how much artificial intelligence or processing power is layered on top, it all rests on basic intelligible logic.
Right.
Demystifying that foundation makes the digital world less like a realm of magic and more like a human-built tool that you have every right to understand.
It's incredibly clarifying to realize that, you know, every swipe, every video stream, every complex calculation happening around us right now is still just a massive, blindingly fast coordination of blindfolded messengers moving packages from box A to box B.
It really is.
But as we wrap up this journey into the raw logic of the 1970s, it leaves me with one final kind of provocative thought for you listening.
Oh!
Yeah. If the author's hand-soldered tape recorder computer was the horse and carriage, and the smartphone in your pocket is the Formula One Ferrari, what will the computers of 50 years from now make our current technology look like?
That is a fascinating question.
Right. And when we reach that unimaginably advanced future, will the fundamental courier logic, the simple sequential picking up and dropping off of instructions, will that still be the beating heart of the machine? Or will computing evolve into an architecture so profoundly different that the underlying mechanics become something else entirely?
That is the perfect question to carry forward as technology continues to accelerate.
Something for you to think about the next time you tap a piece of black glass and wait for the magic to happen. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. We'll catch you on the next one.